Elevate one of the ancient lights of David, minister of the 12th hour apostolic Sabbatarian congregation, not about the 12th hour. In the Liberty Hill, Texas, today is July 9, 2016, or it's age 6, 2020. We will start our first service on this Sabbath day with a song entitled, A Sweet Peace, or the Gift of Yahweh's Love. There comes to my heart one sweet strain, a glutton of joyous refrain. I'll sing it again and again. Sweet peace, the gift of your love. Peace, peace, sweet peace, wonderful gift from above. Oh, wonderful, wonderful peace. Sweet peace, the gift of your love. Through Yahshua on the cross, peace was made. A death by his death was obeyed. No other foundation is laid for the peace, the gift of your love. Peace, peace, sweet peace, wonderful gift from above. Oh, wonderful, wonderful peace. Sweet peace, the gift of Yahshua. When Yahshua's king I had crowned, my heart with his peace did abound. In him that is blessing I found. Sweet peace, the gift of your love. Peace, peace, sweet peace, wonderful gift from above. Oh, wonderful, wonderful peace. Sweet peace, the gift of your love. Yahshua for peace I abide. And as I keep close to his side, there's nothing that peace doth betide. Sweet peace, the gift of Yahshua. Peace, peace, sweet peace, wonderful gift from above. Oh, wonderful, wonderful peace. Sweet peace, the gift of your love. Hello, everyone. Once again, it's Elijah David, and we're going to have a new series starting right now, entitled The Two Babylons. And we're going to learn some things that we never knew was there, but we're going to be excited about it all, and we're going to start go with our prayer thoughts. We're going to continue on with our main word, Cyrus. Cyrus and Darius. And let's go to Daniel chapter 6. Okay, now, it says that, Daniel, 6 verse 1. It pleased Darius to sit over the kingdom and 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes. Now keep in mind that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his three worthies, friends, were also given the title of presidents. But Daniel was preferred above those three and all the princes of the 120, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to sit him over the whole realm. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel. So in this case, I guess these presidents was of the 120 princes altogether. So then the presidents and princes, not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three presidents under Daniel directed, that were Jews, but these 120 princes that were appointed as presidents. Now keep in mind, this 120 princes appointed as presidents were not Jews. They were of the Ishmael Arab descent. Okay? Keep that in mind. Daniel is a Jew and they are Arabs. Daniel is of the seed of Isaac, and these 120 princes are of the seed of Ishmael, after the flesh. That's what you're always contending with in the kingdom. Those that are after the spirit and those that are after the flesh. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Then these presidents and princesses assembled together to the king and said unto him, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his Elohim as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication for his Elohim. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, say to thee, O king, shall be cast to the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. That's where they just make up a new law as they have need of it, and then they get the king to put his seal of approval on it with his ring, and then it can't be changed or altered. That's like the Pharisees. They made up 613 additional rules and laws, and they added them to the law of Moses, but they didn't preach the law of Moses. They preached their 613, over the law of Moses, showing where they were exalting themselves over Yahweh's law. So the Medes and Persians, that's what they were doing, making up their own laws and exalting the law above Yahweh's law. Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not the old king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree or no statute which the king establishes may be changed. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, Thy Elohim, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. See, King Darius knew. And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet, and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Oh boy, we've got him in the den, and we've got a big old stone over in the mouth of that den. Well, we rolled a big stone up there, and then the king put his seal on that and said, Boy, ain't nobody gonna come here and pull that stone away. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Now there were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel, and the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living Elohim, is thy Elohim, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lion? He's addressing Daniel as someone that serves his Yahweh continually. Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My Elohim has sent his angel and has shut the lion's mouth, that they have not hurt me, for as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceeding glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his Yahweh. And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions. Them, their children, and their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them, and brake all their bones in pieces, wherever they came at the bottom of the den. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, Peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the Elohim of Daniel. For he is the living Elohim and steadfast forever in his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lion. But you know, he delivered David from the power of the lion and the power of the bear. And here we have now Daniel, prophecy being opened up here in the 12th hour, in the time that this antithetical reign of David has taken place. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So Daniel, he prospered in the reign of Cyrus the Persian and Darius. The two Babylons. Let's start with Revelation 14, verse 1. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written in their forehead. And I heard a voice from the heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne, and before the four beasts and elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are victims. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto Elohim and unto the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of the Yahweh. Okay, everlasting gospel. Verse 6, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. Now, what is this angel? This is your fifth angel. Now, I know the Adventists have always called this the third angel. Okay? Alright, and that dwell on the earth, and unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people. Well, indeed, this may have very well been the third angel in 1844, but this is the fifth angel in 2016. This would be the fifth angel here in the throne tower, because he certainly brings the everlasting gospel for the living. Otherwise, you couldn't bring this earth to a close. Okay. But the reason why the angel flying in the midst of heaven, the third angel, in 1844, was because he was announcing it's time to start the everlasting gospel message in 1844 that William Miller had introduced in 1833. Alright, so he says, saying with a loud voice, fear Yahweh and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come. Okay, now it says, and worship him that made heaven and earth, and the sea and the fountains of water. Okay, now it says, saying with a loud voice, fear Yahweh, the Father, and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come. Why is it called the hour of Yahweh's judgment? Why is it called the hour of his judgment? Because he is the great judge. He's the one that sits upon that throne above the mercy seat in the most holy place on the Day of Atonement. He's the one that receives the petition from his son, Yahshua, to blot out the sins of the repentant sinner on the Day of Atonement. So, what do you got here? You got the great judge, which is Yahweh the Father, sitting up on his throne. So that's the reason why it says that the hour of his judgment is come. So now, it just simply means that the hour of his judgment came in the tenth hour. It came in the tenth hour. And it will end at the end of the 12th hour, the two phases of it. The judgment of the dead begin in the 10th hour, at the beginning of the 10th hour. Now keep that in mind. And the judgment of the living begins at the beginning of the 12th hour. Keep that in mind. Saith the loud voice, fear Yahweh and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come. And worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. And what did Yahshua say? Worship the Father, and him only shalt thou worship. Okay. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. And what's the name of our study, our series? The two Babylons. Okay, so I'm introducing to you a Babylon here, the first phase of this antithetical Babylon that you're going to find in the Revelation 17, the mystery Babylon. We're going to learn something about this mystery Babylon if we get into the book, the two Babylon. So anyway, it says, and there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Okay, why is it called of her? Because Babylon is represented by that unclean woman. Okay, that called Mystery Babylon in Revelation 17. And that unclean woman is also a very real living person today in our time. Just like the man of sin is a very real living person in our time. And that can only be one man of sin at a time. Lucifer being the first man of sin, and then his successors, one at a time. At the cross, it was Judas Iscariot. Okay. The man of sin at the Garden of Eden, the original man of sin that caused Adam and Eve to sin, and then his successor was Cain, the firstborn of Adam and Eve. And then in Noah's day, it was Ham, the second son. That was a man of sin, son of perdition. And then in our day, it'd be the true prophet turned false prophet, like Balaam. Balaam turned from a true prophet to not a false prophet, but a bad prophet, an apostatized prophet. Couldn't deny the truth, but he could sure try to subvert Yahweh's people that was living perfect lives, living in perfect harmony with heaven. He could sure reveal secrets to the evil king of Moab, Balak, how to seduce Israel into idolatry and it cost the lives of 23,000 priests in one day. He could sure do that, and he did. All right, now. So it says in verse 9, and the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of Yahweh, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with the fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Okay, so now, let's go to Revelation 17, and it says, verse 1, and there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, And I saw a woman set up on a scarlet colored beast full of the names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of the abomination and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon, the Great, the Mother of Harlots, and Abominations of the Earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of the Yahshua. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of the life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And there is and here is the mind which hath wisdom, the 7 heads of 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. And I said, here is the mind which hath wisdom. Okay. So I said, and there are 7 kings, 5 are fallen, and 1 is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the 8th, and is of the 7, and goeth into perdition. Now, isn't this amazing? We got a beast going into perdition, meaning that he can't return from that going into perdition. He cannot return out of it. He can never have a second chance to come and be saved. And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Okay. These have 1 mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the lamb. So they're going to give their power and strength to the beast, and then they're going to... That beast then is going to tell these 10 horns now that go now and declare war on the lamb. Okay, these shall make war with the lamb, and the lamb shall overcome them, for he is the sovereign of sovereign and king of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Okay, so those that are with this lamb are called, chosen, and faithful. So, I remember the day that I was called to go to work in the vineyard in the beginning of the 11th hour in Kermit, Texas, 1970. And I had no trouble accepting the invitation. And I've been laboring at it ever since. Okay, it says, And he saith unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the horse sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. Okay. For Elohim hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and the decree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of Yahweh shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Is that great city Babylon. Now, pay close attention as we go into this book, The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. And let's just start with page 1 on chapter 1 and see what we find here. Because on page 2, we're going to lead right into a name entitled Cyrus. And you're going to be interested in knowing about where Cyrus fits into this here, to Babylon. The antitypical Cyrus I'm talking about, Donald Trump. This, there is a, well, actually, I want to get past the introduction, chapter 1 now. Chapter 1, it says, well, actually, it's the introduction that I want to start with. It says, there is a difference. There is this great difference between the works of men and the works of Yahweh, that the same minute and searching investigation, which displays the defects and the imperfections of the one, brings out also the beauties of the other. If the most finely polished needle on which the art of man has been expended be subjected to a microscope, many inequalities, much roughness and clumsiness will be seen. But if the microscope be brought to bear on the flowers of the field, no such result appears. Instead of their beauty diminishing, new beauties and still more delicate that have escaped the naked eye are forthwith discovered. Beauties that make us appreciate in a way which otherwise we could have had little conception of. The full force of the Yahweh said, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you, that even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. The same law appears also in the comparing of the word of Yahweh and the most finished productions of the men. There are spots and blemishes in the most admired productions of human genius. But the more the scriptures are searched, the more minutely they are studied. The more their perfection appears, new beauties are brought into the light every day. And the discoveries of the science, the researches of the learned, and the labors of the infidel, all alike conspire to illustrate the wonderful harmony of all the parts and the divine beauty that clothes the world. If this be the case with the scriptures in general, it is especially the case with the prophetic scriptures, as every spoke in the wheel of a providence revolved, the prophetic symbols start into still more bold and beautiful relief. This is very strikingly the case with the prophetic language that forms the groundwork and the cornerstone of the present work. There never has been any difficulty in the mind of any enlightened Protestant in the identifying the woman sitting on seven mountains and having on her forehead the name written, Mystery Babylon the Great. With the Roman apostasy, no other city in the world has ever been celebrated as the city of Rome has. For its situation on seven hills, pagan poets and orators who had no thought of elucidating prophecy have alike characterized it as a seven-hilled city. Thus, Virgil refers to it. Rome has both become the most beautiful city in the world, and alone has surrounded for herself seven heights with a veil, with a wall. Paratus, in the same strain, speaks of it only adding another trait, which completes the apocalyptic picture as the lofty city on seven hills, which governs the whole world. Its governing the whole world is just the counterpart of the divine statement, which reigneth over the kings of the earth, Revelation 18. Revelation 17:18. To call Rome the city of the seven hills was by its citizens held to be as descriptive as to call it by its own proper name. Hence, Horace speaks of it by the reference to its seven hills alone when he addresses the gods who have set their affections on the seven hills. Marital, in like manner, speaks of the seven dominating mountains. In the times long subsequent, the same kind of language was in the current use. So when Semiramis, the prefect of the city and the last acting pagan pontifex Maximus, as the imperial substitute, introduces by letter one friend of his to another, he calls them De Septem Montibus of Virum, a man from the seven mountains, meaning thereby, as the commentators interpreted, Seven Romanum, Romanum, R-O-M-A-N-U-M, a Roman citizen. Now, while this characteristic of Rome has ever been well marked and defined, it has always been easy to show that the church, which has its seat and headquarters on the seven hills of Rome, might most appropriately be called Babylon, inasmuch as it is the chief seat of idolatry under the New Testament, as the ancient Babylon was the chief seat of idolatry under the Old Testament. But recent discoveries in the Assyria, taken in connection with the previously well-known but ill-understood history and mythology of the ancient world, demonstrate that there is a vast deal more significant in the name Babylon the Great than this. It has been known all along that popery was baptized paganism, but Elohim is now making it manifest that the paganism which Rome has baptized is, in all of its essential elements, the very paganism which prevailed in the ancient literal Babylon when the Yahweh opened before Cyrus, get this now, the two leaf gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron. That new and unexpected light in some way or other should be cast about this very period. Should be cast. Okay, about this very period, on the Church of the Grand Apostasy. Pay attention to this word apostasy. The very language and symbols of the apocalypse might have prepared us to anticipate in the apocalyptic vision. It is just before the judgment upon her that for the first time John sees the apostate church. Now, when he says apostate church, he's talking about Rome. But you know, Rome would have to have been called the true church at once before she could be considered apostate. That's what the Adventists were called, the true Israel, the spiritual Israel of today, but when they apostatize, what are they called? They're called the apostate Israel's church. This is the Israel church that has apostatized. Well, Rome did join the Christians in the first century, pagan Rome, and they did pay people to join the Christian movement, and they did make a pretense to have accepted the government of heaven, Rome did, with the apostles, and to follow the statutes and the judgments and the feast days and so forth according to the right time. Maybe that's what gives them the pattern for setting up a counterfeit system then during the Dark Ages, and called Catholicism. So in that sense, they would be called the apostate church, having joined the apostolic movement in the first century, the pagan Rome did, and forced her people, her converts, to go and join the Christians. And then whenever they got the Christians in their ranks, then they started apostatizing back to lukewarmism. In other words, they believed partly in man customs and partly in Yahweh's laws and so forth. So that's the way you would call Rome then an apostate church. If at one time she had joined the house of Israel and then end up being the house of Catholicism, then you could call that an apostate church, having backslidden, in other words. That's what the Adventists did. They backslid into Catholicism in 1890. All right? So it says, now this is Alexander Hislop. He's talking about in the apocalyptic visions, it is just before the judgment upon her, that's upon Babylon, that for the first time John sees the apostate church with the name Babylon. Now see, John sees his apostate pagan Rome church with the name Babylon. So she was named Babylon before she was named Catholicism. The pagan Rome was named Babylon of the New Testament before she was named Catholicism. Written upon her forehead, Revelation 17:5. What means the writing of that name on the forehead? Does it not naturally indicate that just before the judgment overtakes her, her real character was to be so thoroughly developed that everyone who has eyes to see, who has the least spiritual discernment, would be compelled, as it were, on the ocular demonstration for the recognizing of the wonderful fitness of the title that the spirit of the Elohim had affixed unto her. For her judgment is now evidently hastening on. Okay, so now Mystery Babylon is Hillary Clinton, in light of all of her sins that are being opened up now for the last 30 years that she has committed. And amidst all of the attention she's getting from the FBI and the Justice Department and from all other departments of the world, and with the world looking on, she's still pushing ahead to become the queen of this world and sit upon the throne of Mystery Babylon at Washington, D.C., and just as it approaches the providence, for the providence of the Elohim, conspiring with the word of the Elohim by the light pouring in from all quarters, makes it more and more evident that the Rome, says that Rome, but I'll put the article there, that the Rome is in the very deed, in the very deed is the Babylon of the Apocalypse. Okay? That the essential character of her system, the grand objects of her worship, her festivals, her doctrine and discipline, her rites and ceremonies, her priesthood and their orders have all been derived from the ancient Babylon. But I want to put this in, but she would have never known how to set up her administration of all these relics from ancient Babylon if she hadn't joined the Jewish apostolic movement in the first century to learn the true time for keeping the Passover, the Pentecost, and the Atonement, and all of the holy days, and the Sabbath. If she had not joined the apostolic movement, she would have known then in the New Testament how to set up this counterfeit system. And now she has a legitimate reason for setting up this counterfeit system. All she's got to do is say, well, the first pope was Peter, and Peter passed the keys on to the next pope of Catholicism, and Yahweh gave the pope his authority and his seat and authority to do what he did. That is to counterfeit the ordained system of true worship of the sanctuary and create their own relics and their own idols and write their own theory for a theocracy that they were destined to control and operate, a theocracy, church and state. So they had 1260 years to do this. And finally, that the Pope himself is truly and properly the lineal representative of Belshazzar. In the warfare that has been waged against the domineering pretensions of Rome, it has too often been counted enough merely to meet and set aside her presumption or presumptuous boast that she is the mother and mistress of all churches, the one Catholic Church, out of whose pale, P-A-L-E, there is no salvation. If ever there was an excuse for such a mode of dealing with her, that excuse will hold on. That excuse will hold no longer if the position I have laid down can be maintained. She must be stripped of the name of a Christian church altogether. So she still carries that title, though, Christian Church. And she says all these other churches have joined her and make it one union of churches worldwide. And they're the head, calling themselves the head Christians of all these others that have joined them. For if it was a church of Yahshua that was convened on that night, when the Pontiff King of Babylon, in the midst of his thousand lords, this is Belshazzar now, the last king of Babylon before Cyrus overthrew him, and you know who Antipical King Cyrus is today, that's Donald Trump. He is very much active out there and running for the rulership of this country. And who is the Antipical Belshazzar? None other but then Obama. That's sitting there on the throne, and Donald Trump is on his way to take over that throne. Praise the that this here Pontiff King of Babylon, in the midst of his thousand lords, that's Belshazzar. That's the night when they were weighed the balance and found wanting, and King Belshazzar, Cyrus came in and killed the king Belshazzar and overthrew Babylon, and set the Jews free, because their 70-year period was up, and then helped them to go back to Jerusalem and build not only the city, but they had to first build the wall. Now, what is Donald Trump saying in his campaign? First thing I'm going to do is we're going to build that wall. Well, what is that telling us? That's the first thing that Cyrus did in the time. The first thing he ordered the Jews, get back to Jerusalem, I'll pay for it, and build that wall. So that's his thing today. So apparently then the United States represents the headquarters for the New Jerusalem, Texas being its main headquarter place for this, in the heart of the United States. And we have an antipodal Cyrus that says, build that wall. Okay. And he says, our enemies that is trying to take over our land and has come in here by the millions already and occupying it, saying this is our land anyway, we're going to keep it. No, they're going to pass back over their stronghold for fear of the ensign that's going to be set up in this land. That ensign is the house of David, tribe of Judah, the lawgiver. Yahshua and antithetical David represents this ensign because their banner, their flag that they're flying, is with the line of the tribe of Judah and the six-pointed star of David on it. And that's their emblem. All right. So it says, praise the gods. Let's read this again. If it was a church of Yahshua that was convened on that night, when the pontiff king Belshazzar, I won't put the name in there, it's not in here, of Babylon, that's who was in there, in the midst of his thousand lords, praised the gods of gold and silver and of wood and of stone. All right, let's translate that now up to present tense. For if it was a church of Yahshua that was convened on that night when the pontiff king Barack Obama, antitypical Belshazzar of Babylon, in the midst of his thousand lords, praised the gods and gold and of silver and of wood and of stone, Daniel 5:4, then the Church of Rome is entitled unto the name of a Christian church. So what did Obama say when he was running for president the first time? He's talking about reporters getting a fair reporting. And he said this one reporter gave him a fair reporting. And he respected my Christian faith. No, he said he respected my Muslim faith. And this other reporter that was interviewing him, he said, you mean my Christian faith? He said, oh, yeah, my Christian faith. The one that said that he has not mentioned my name, that was John McCain, when a senator from Arizona that was running for president against Obama. He was campaigning against him in 2008. And Obama said, well, he's had respect to me and my Christian faith. My Muslim faith, he said. Said he hasn't mentioned my Muslim faith. Said he's had respect for my... And that reporter says, you mean your Christian faith? And he kind of just looked so funny and nodded. He said, my Christian faith. And that's the only time that word Christian has ever passed Obama's lips in the 8 years he's been in office. Was when he slipped and said my Muslim faith, and he had to correct it by saying, I mean my Christian faith. All right, that told it all. But not otherwise. This, to some, no doubt, will appear a very startling position. But it is one which is the object of this work to establish, and let the reader judge for himself whether I do not bring ample evidence to substantiate my position. Okay. That ends page 3. Now we're going to go right on into page 4. It says, distinctive character of the two systems. Well, in the leading proof of the Babylonian character of the papal churches, the first point to which I solicit the reader's attention is the character of the mystery which attaches alike to the modern Roman and the ancient Babylonian system, the gigantic system of the moral corruption and idolatry described in this passage under the emblem of a woman with a golden cup in her hand. Okay, now today this is translated in the antitype. Hillary Clinton is this here woman in a literal form of a human being. All right. Revelation 17:4, making all nations drink, it says, with the wine of her fornication. Revelation 17:2, and Revelation 18:3. I'm going to go to my Bible right quick and check on that, if that's a correct rendering of that. Okay, that's a correct expression. Let's go ahead. It says that is divinely called mystery, Babylon the Great. Revelation 17:5. That Paul's mystery of iniquity, as described in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 7, has its counterpart in the Church of Rome. No man of a candid mind who has carefully examined the subject can easily doubt. Such was the impression made by that account on the mind of the great Sir Matthew Hale, no mean judge of the evidence that he used to say that if the apostolic description were inserted in the public hue and cry, any constable in the realm would be warranted in seizing wherever he found him, for the Bishop of Rome as the head of that mystery of iniquity. Now, as the system here described is equally characterized by the name of mystery, it may be presumed that both passages refer to the same system. But this language applied to the New Testament Babylon, as the reader cannot fail to see, naturally leads us back to the Babylon of the ancient world. As the apocalyptic woman was in her hand a cup, wherewith she intoxicates the nation, so was it with the Babylon of old. Of that Babylon, while in all its glory, the Yahweh thus spake, and denouncing its doom by the prophet Jeremiah. Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Yahweh's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad. Jeremiah 7. That's Jeremiah 51:7. Why this exact similarity of language in regard to the two systems? For the natural inference surely is that the one stands to the other in the relation of the type and anti-type. Now, as the Babylon of the Apocalypse is characterized by the name of mystery, so the grand distinguishing feature of the ancient Babylonian system was the Chaldean mysteries. And they were Muslims, they were Arabs, that formed so essential a part of that system. And to these mysteries, the very language of the Hebrew prophet, symbolical though, of course, it is distinctly alludes when he speaks of the Babylon as a golden cup, the drink of the mysterious beverage. Says Salverti was indispensable on the part of all who sought initiation into these mysteries. These mysterious beverages were composed of wine, honey, water and flour, from the ingredients avowedly used and from the nature of others not avowed but certainly used, there can be no doubt that they were of an intoxicating nature. Until the aspirants had come under their power, till their understandings had been dimmed and their passions excited by their medicated drought, They were not duly prepared for what they were either to hear or to see. If it be inquired what was the object and design of these ancient mysteries, it will be found that there was a wonderful analogy between them and that mystery of iniquity, which is embodied in the Church of Rome. Their primary object was to introduce privately, by little and little, under the seal of secrecy and the sanction of an oath. Hillary Clinton, she just got grilled by the FBI, but they didn't put her under oath. And now they're saying, they're referring the case to the Congress, and the Congress says, we're going to have to put her under oath. So here's that oath coming up now. But it would not have been safe all at once, openly, to propound. The time at which they were instituted proves that this must have been the case. For the Chaldean mysteries, which is Muslim, Arabic, and that's what Hillary Clinton, this mystery Bible woman today, represents, she is on their side, she is promoting them, can be traced up to the days of Semiramis, who lived only a few centuries after the flood, and who is known to have impressed upon them the image of her own depraved and polluted mind. This is Hillary Clinton. Semiramis is a type of Hillary Clinton today. This mysteries of this mysterious mysteries of Babylon. That beautiful, but abandoned queen of Babylon was not only herself a paragon of unbridled lust and licentiousness, and we know Hillary Clinton fixed that description to 100%, but in the mysteries which she had a chief hand in forming, she was worshipped as Rhea, the great mother of the gods, with such atrocious rites as identified her with Venus, the mother of all impurity, and that's Hillary Clinton, and raised the very city where she had reigned to a bad eminence among the nations as the grand seat at once of idolatry and consecrated prostitution. Thus was this Chaldean queen, the Semiramis, a type of Hillary Clinton today, a fit and remarkable prototype of the woman, Hillary Clinton, in the apocalypse, with the golden cup in her hand and the name on her forehead, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Figure 1. The apocalyptic emblem of the harlot woman with the cup in her hand was even embodied in the symbols of idolatry derived from the ancient Babylon as they were exhibited in Greece. For thus was the Greek Venus originally represented, and it is singular that in our own day, and so far as appears for the first time, the Roman Church has actually taken this very symbol as her own chosen emblem. In 1825, on the occasion of the Jubilee, Pope Leo XII struck a medal bearing on the one side his own image and on the other that of the Church of Rome, symbolized as a woman, holding in her left hand a cross and in her right cup with the legend around her. Sedet super universum. The whole world is her seat. Now, the period when Semiramis lived, a period when the patriarchal faith was still fresh in the minds of men, when Shem was still alive. Shem is the firstborn of Noah after the flood that carried on the righteous line. To rouse the minds of the faithful to rally around the banner for the truth and the cause of Yahweh made it hazardous all at once and publicly to set up such a system as was inaugurated by the Babylonian queen. We know from the statements in Job that among the patriarchal tribes that had nothing whatsoever to do with Mosaic institutions, but which adhered to the pure faith of the patriarchs, idolatry in any shape was held to be a crime to be visited with the signal and summary punishment on the heads of those who practice it. Now, did you see why Brother Johnson was tested on the number one idolatry that he was practicing and allowing to be practiced in the Church of Gilead Center? That was in birthday celebrations. That was the most abominable of them all. And according to heaven, it's a crime. And here he is, a prophet, and in charge of the candlestick of Laodicea. And he's the one set up to keep the light burning in the sanctuary and to keep it ever burning, never let the oil go out or get low. But here he is right here committing a terrible crime against heaven. If I beheld the sun, said Job, when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart hath been secretly enticed, and my mouth had kissed my hand, this also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied the Elohim that is above. That is in Job 31:26-28. Now, if this was the case in Job's day, much more must it have been the case at the earlier period when the mysteries were instituted. This brings to close our study this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour call, and that's the number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close this now with it. Rock of Ages, click for me. Rock of Ages, click for me. Rock of Ages, click for me. Let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood from the wounded side which flow. Yes, send the double cure. Save from wrath and make me pure. Let my tears forever flow. Could my zeal no language know? Is for sin could not atone. Thou must save and thou art Lord. In my hand no price I bring. Simply to the cross I cling. I draw this fleeting breath, when my heart shall close in death, when I rise to worlds unknown, and behold thee on the throne. Rock of Ages, lift for me, let me hide myself in thee.